thanks for having me back. 10 years later, the guys who I saw 10 years ago. You guys are a little older. Some are a little fatter. Some are a little thinner. I'm 45 pounds less than you saw me 10 years ago, and 7 inches less at the waist. And I'm doing my part to lower the clergy BMI, which is expanding at an alarming rate, especially in the Midwestern regions. I stand here today before you with a renewed sense of my own mortality, as well as my own incompetence. So we're going to have a good time together. Mortality in the sense that, you know, I'm now 58. I was 48 when I first appeared here. I just got on blood pressure meds. So I wasn't used to the medicated way of life, which means that before you travel, you always have to get your pill box in order, and then it increased to 2 pill boxes, the morning bunch and the evening bunch. But I didn't do the pill box. Who picked me up from the airport 10 years ago? Was that Michael?
I did.
Yeah, so remember we had that little brief encounter with the Canadian healthcare system?
Yeah.
As we tried to convince a pharmacist that this American needed his blood pressure meds, and, you know, nothing's going to work in Canada. So you remember the resolution of that? Finally, he emerges from the back after about 20 minutes of, I don't know, personal agony, whatever he was doing, with a little envelope with 3 days' worth of pills saying, "You don't know where you got these from." And so, come home, and I told my wife, the Canadian healthcare system is great. It's free drugs. I don't know where I get them. This is great. So those pill boxes multiplied, and finally, you know, type 2 diabetes was setting in, and I said, enough is enough. So I did a little sort of reversal of growth in ministry, and that had its own sort of side effects too. You probably have noticed I have more stitches in the forehead than I did 10 years ago. I had 20 from a high school gym class accident, and now I got 11 more, nine next to that one, and 2 over on the other side. I like to say it's the Stanley Cup final, and most guys grow beards, but since I had a beard, I thought 11 stitches to the forehead kind of looked the part for hockey, you know, and you have some stitches. What happened was I got up in the wee hours of the morning, and you guys over 50, you know what the wee hours are about, don't you? The wee hours of the morning. It's about 3 a.m., and just, you know, being in much better physical condition than I've ever been in my life, I didn't pause at the edge of the bed, but I just stood up, boom, and went to do the wee hours of the morning thing. And as I'm standing there contemplating the meaning of my life, my world started pixelating. And when you faint, the last thing you think of is, I'm going to faint.
Yeah.
And then the first thing you think of when you emerge from that is, I fainted. There's nothing in between. There's no bright light. There's no vision. There's no, you know, here am I, send me moment. It's just like, so, but when I awakened, I was actually in the hallway. I don't know how I got from bathroom to hallway. I'm thankful I got from bathroom to hallway because had I fallen in the bathroom, I have small bathrooms. There are any number of ways I could have hit my noggin and not be here today. But instead, I managed to get out in the hallway. I apparently hit my shoulder in the door jamb and did a face plant into the hardwood floor that I installed about 10 years ago in my living room. And I awakened in kind of this pool of my own blood, which is that's a life-changing moment. Right? With my wife kind of kneeling beside me, you know, my first thoughts were, you know, as I reached to my forehead and my hand soaking with blood, is she did this. and I laid there for a long time because I didn't want to get up, and I knew where I was. I just didn't know why I was where I was. And I'm feeling this, and I thought the old scar had opened because there's like this gaping wound, and nothing bleeds like a head wound. It looks like a crime scene when you injure your head. I had 15 stitches at the top of my head when a coffin lid opened. That's a long story. I'm not going to tell you. They use staples there because you can't see that part until I lose all my hair. But anyway, so and the smoke detector on the wall is making the sound. It's going. It's not the full bore thing. It's not the I'm out of batteries thing. It's just kind of a weak, anemic. And I asked my wife, I said, what's that noise? Blood all over the place. What's that noise? She says, it's coming out of you. And I'm thinking, dear Lord Jesus, take me. I mean, I thought it was over. Because, like, nobody should emit that sound. And then I said, no, it's the smoke detector. It's not me. So I get up and reassemble myself, go to the hospital. Long story short, 11 stitches to the forehead. There is nothing that brings you back to the fundamentals of your baptism, like waking up at 3 a.m. in a pool of your own blood with the smoke detector going, and your wife saying, that sound is coming out of you. So I'm lighter, I'm leaner, I'm in great shape, and it's still a 58-year-old body that is prone to tipping over in the wee hours of the morning. I'm off all those drugs. By the way, the fainting spell, if you're curious, has to do with vaguely. I have three explanations for this. One's, how'd you get all those stitches in your head? My fun answer is, I have no idea. That's the creepy answer. The truthful answer, well, the evasive answer is, it has to do with 4 shots of tequila, 2 prescription medications, and getting up too quickly. I'm not going to go any further than that. I told my lovingly call my postmenopausal Bible class. Let the hearer understand. I told them that, and their busy little church lady minds were just trying to fill in the blanks of that narrative, like right now. Tequila, prescription medications, stitches to the forehead. So.
Oh, yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah. But I'm thrilled to be back here, a little more bruised and beaten, and as I said, with a renewed sense of my own incompetence. I once said at a pastor's retreat, just saying what we all thought, that every morning I wake up with great expectations for what can be accomplished in the day, and every evening I retire to a glass of something, usually high-end tequila. Realizing how much I suck at what I do. And I had this stunned look from these pastors in the room, as though I had said something we dare not ever say out loud. And I realized, we all know this deep down. And that's what I love about the gazebo last night. I love many things about the gazebo, but it's a place of, like, total honesty. It's also a place where I'm reminded why it's probably good for me to drink whiskey instead of tequila, because the hangover that I have right now is, I don't get that with tequila, see, so I'd be a raging alcoholic with tequila. That's why I drink expensive stuff, because I can't afford to be a raging alcoholic, but this whiskey thing has intrinsic punishments. Mortifying old Adam in just the right way, so. This morning I want to talk about this first session, I just want to reflect back on 10 years and indulge me this a little bit, because I'm getting to that point now where 23 years in the ministry, I'm seeing a lot of preachers who are younger than me now. And I like that. I love listening to the younger preachers because they're actually still excited about this. they haven't gone through the lectionary 8 times, or if you're a 1-year guy, 24 times. You got this. How many times do you have to parse this verb? But you actually have discovered new things in the text, and you're genuinely excited about it. And I love hearing that. So I love that. I love the fact that you actually think that you have to teach the whole counsel of God in a sermon. We've given up on that long ago. If they remember one point, we're happy. If I can stay on one point, I'm happy. It's good. I've also developed a profound respect for the old guys that I never had before. When I was out of the seminary, I was a critic of the word, not a hearer. It's an occupational hazard. And yeah, it's like the people in the movie industry. I'm from LA area, and people in the industry can't go to movies because they will dissect the movie. And they will analyze, they will look for plot continuity. Oh, hey, look at that, that face moved. You know, it's like, why can't you just watch the movie? What's wrong with you? But they can't, because they're insiders, and we're insiders. And I realized over the years that I'd become a critic of the word and not a hearer when I was in the pew. And my wife would reach over and she'd grab my hand, and by the temperature of my hand, she could tell how the preaching and liturgy was going. Because I'm very, you know, I'm hypertensive. So when my hands were cold, it was not good. You know? When my hands were hot, it was good. But I have learned to appreciate and to enjoy and to draw strength and comfort from the humble craft of the old veterans of the pulpit. I really have. And I used to think they were just kind of, you know, dowdy idiots that are basically, you know, barely ambulatory and basically just hanging on. And now I'm beginning to hear and understand the depth of the wisdom of what they have gone through, the scars of body and soul that they bring into the pulpit, the wrestling with the text that they have done, the wrestling with the people and connecting those people to that text that they've done. And so I have come to appreciate the work of the pastors who are much older than I am to a much greater extent, and then also my contemporaries. We've been through the seven together, we've had the same teachers, we're in this together. So I hope that our time together today and tomorrow is a time of kind of looking at this work that we're given to do and encouraging one another, whether, you know, newer pastor, older pastor, burned out pastor, encouraging one another in this incredible work of connecting God's people to God's word, making that connection, because this is a work unlike any other work. 30 years ago, when I decided to go to the seminary, I really, really thought that this was going to be great. And I've said this before in other contexts. Had I known then what I know now, I would have stayed in science, would have finished the PhD in chemistry, would have gone on to make big bucks like my brother, would probably be a raging alcoholic and probably an atheist. I have no idea what it would be. But knowing what I do know 23 years after I've been ordained, I wouldn't trade this for the world. It's just this odd love-hate thing. Because I hate what I do and I love what I do. And I think that's how it should be. It's like Jeremiah, you know, you tricked me. God got some skips, so. Over the 23 years that I've been preaching, the ears have changed. This is something that I wouldn't have known 30 years ago when I decided to leave science, go to the seminary, become a pastor. I never thought that a society would redefine its own institutions like marriage and we'd have to speak on it. I never thought that the things that I learned in science would be used against the faith that I held. You know, I was a scientist. I'm a skeptic. I know evidence. I know experiments. I know the whole thing. This never rattled my faith in Christ. A second, I was a scientist who happened to be a Christian. I was a Christian who happened to be a scientist, and these two things just work fine. And now I have high school kids and college age young people bringing their science to me and saying, "This is why I don't believe this anymore. This is why I don't believe the Bible anymore." And they're lecturing me as though I hadn't thought of these things. And I never thought that I would have to deal with that level of skepticism so quickly, so easily, so fastly. I don't know how your mileage may vary on some of this. Spiritual apathy. Apathy is the worst thing. You can hate something and love something at the same time. There's passion in that. I mean, there are times I'm sure my wife hates me. But she loves me, which is why she hates me sometimes, because I'm hard to love sometimes. But apathy, you can't do anything. That is just dead. And it's not that people hate the church. It's that they just don't care about the church. And even the good, what I call the conservative Christian Republican Lutheran people, seem apathetic. They do not care. They don't care about their congregation. They don't care about the state of the church. They don't care about their neighbor. They don't care about their own spiritual lives. We seem to be suffering from a techno kind of ADD, where we can't concentrate on anything for more than about 10 seconds. I'm convinced. I'm on a two-year writer's block. I have editors that are threatening my life at this point. I screen my calls. I tell my parish administrator, if so-and-so calls, I'm not here. You don't know where I am. These are my editors. They're looking for me. I have chapters. They're waiting. I can't write. I'm convinced that Facebook has killed my ability to write. I'm not joking. I mean, I all my good thoughts are wasted in comment streams. And I've shot my wad before I've written a paragraph. And this is not some techno rant. I'm just my brain has changed. And I ask, well, what's different? Well, you're older. Yeah, it's true. You fell on your forehead. Yeah, that's also true. But that's the big thing that's changed. I mean, even before we got up, I had to do a little, I am thing. My wife and girlfriends, whatever else is going on there. And it's, Also, the kids, more than us, but the kids are suffering this techno-autism. I had an organist intern, lovely girl named Anna, and I took her to lunch. We toured some things around L.A., bought her a nice lunch, and she's trying to hide it. She's under the table doing this. And I said, Anna, put that thing away. I just bought you lunch. I want a half hour of your undivided attention. The kids are socially awkward. They deal with each other through devices. It's easier to communicate through a device than face to face, but face to face is really scary. That's gazebo scary out there. Truly touching you. Yeah, I mean, you want some technology between you. You want some
direct communication, baby.
Truly touching you is scary.
It is scary.
But in a very exciting
way. Yeah, I always tell when I come back to the end, I come back strangely refreshed. it's this odd mixture of, being debauched, hungover, and yet somehow energized and refreshed. It's a contradiction. The mindset of the people, my neighbors, the people I encounter, the kids, my own congregation is increasingly a secularized mindset. It's a segmented thing. There's a spiritual component to their lives, but they basically live their lives in a secularized kind of way. It's a media-saturated world. And I think that's hurting us. And if we stop and think about it, we should become very, very afraid, because the oral word is a very difficult word to convey in a media-saturated environment. We're visual. I intentionally did not do the PowerPoint thing. I'm good at PowerPoint. I coach others how to do PowerPoint. I didn't want to do it because it's a preacher's thing. When I teach homiletics at Irvine, I get all these retreads from other, it's a colloquy program. So you get all the retreads from other traditions, and they come, you write a sermon on this, and they come with their fill-in-the-blanks outline. Their hand has to put that. They come with the, do you got a projector? I got PowerPoint here. No. I said, I'm not saying don't use it. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm not saying this is not good communication. Whatever. But the fundamental task is the word. It's communication. It's face-to-face. It may be stumbling. It may be difficult. It may be hard to listen to. But we have to engage this before we put up the pictures, before we pass out the outlines, before we have the fill-in-the-blank exercise. So learn to preach. So I come from this land of illusions, of make-believe. And the problem is that what goes on in church is the most real thing of our lives. It is the most, naked truth there is in our lives. And we increasingly don't want to hear it. We want to hear the illusion. It's like the little kid that comes up to me and says, he says, Pastor, does church have to be boring? And he was a little bit, you know, so I get down to his level and I go, yes. I said, Mickey Mouse is entertaining. But I said, Mickey Mouse isn't real. Jesus is real. And I said, the hard thing, the thing even people my age don't want to deal with is reality is boring. Marriage is boring. Beautifully so, but boring. Affairs are exciting. That's why people have them. It's exciting. It's entertaining. It doesn't last. Taking care of the stuff, tending a congregation, tending the farm, cooking food for the family. It's dull. It's boring. It's real. And that's why if preaching is real, it should be about... It should be unpacking with words the real thing. And that kind of leads to the last thing is I think one of the big problems a lot of people have is their head is filled with God buzz. Just a lot of God talk. You know, they can download sermons on the internet, they can listen to the Christian radio, there's a lot of God talk, but it's a lot of smoke and mirrors illusion. Sunday nights I always drop off to sleep about 10:30. In my favorite chair. And then I awaken about 11 to go to bed. Real bad move. It makes for the wee hours of the morning part of it. And when I awaken to Joel Osteen.
Oh dear.
It's a descent into hell. I honestly think that I have died and I have gone to hell. But I wake up and you're very like receptive to this when you're awakened from sleep. And I listen to this and I said, I cannot believe that intelligent people will gather together in hordes to listen to this bullshit. And to look at him, it's an illusion. The wife, it's an illusion. I'm waiting for the big marital blow-up. You know under the hood, something is rattling under there. But they'll never, you know, you can never show that. You can never see that. Now, having said that, a word of caution. The pulpit is not the place for your own angst, okay? Save it for the gazebo. That's why the gazebo. The people want to hear a word of authority. They want to hear with all dead certainty that this dead and risen Jesus justifies them before God because they suck at what they do. They don't want to know that you suck at what you do. You know that. They know that too. Don't say that to them. We say that to each other. Because we're practitioners, we're craftsmen, we got to be honest with each other. Don't say that to them, but don't pretend that it's otherwise either. You know, that Osteen facade of the perfect life, the perfect wife, the perfect children. The beauty of children is they refuse, the beauty of parish children is they refuse to be perfect. One gets pregnant out of wedlock, one ends up in jail, one's on drugs, and that one becomes a pastor, and you know, I mean, you know, but... You don't know. It's a wild card thing, and that's reality, and I think it's good for the parish to see the reality of your life as a sinner saint. But this is not the pulpit. The council is not the place to vent your anxieties. That's what we have each other for. I've seen some shifts and changes in things. Atheism has become fashionable. It's a little bit like being gay. Nobody would, like, actually... I don't believe anybody chooses to be gay because, you know, oh, yeah, I'm going to get beat up on the playground by all the kids. And no, we don't do that. But it's fashionable to be approving of it. Most of my younger types are perfectly okay with gay. Perfectly okay. And you say, you know, here's what's wrong with it. Here's why. So, you know, let them have their way. And I think it's just a secularized, skeptical mindset that's kind of set in. So it doesn't make sense not to just kind of let people have their way. I've seen what people seem to be looking for, and what they can't find is what they call relevance or authenticity. And I think what they mean by that is real. They're looking for some reality. And what goes on in church ought to be the most hyper of reality, the most real of reals that there is. And we're not quite connecting with them. And I think part of the problem is that we're trying to keep step with a culture that worships entertainment and wants to be entertained. And like I told the little kid, it ain't entertaining. Neither is family supper, neither is going to work every day. This is not entertaining. This is the real stuff of your real life. But people have been accustomed or being trained to look to the church for spiritual entertainment, for inspiration. The gospel has shifted from forgiveness to acceptance. It's not about forgiveness of sins, but it's about acceptance of who I am just as I am without any notion of change. Now, this is going to run headlong into a Lutheran gospel that says, your attempts at change are destined to fail. You can do some superficial stuff. You can stop drinking so much, and that will improve your headache and probably your blood numbers, too. But in the end, your addictions, your idolatries, your lack of fear, love, and trust in God above all things, the only way to deal with that is to die and rise. So no rehab, death and resurrection. And that's a tough one to sell in a society that's looking to try to improve itself and trick itself that it's improving. I'm getting better every day. My BMI is down to 22. I'm an improved human being. God should be pleased with me. I'm a bigger sinner, skinny than I was fat. Because now I'm proud. Now I'm proud. Now I look down at all those fat people. What's wrong with them? They're lazy. Go with the program. The old Adam just latches on to every good thing and makes it a source of pride. You know, I'm pro-life. I'm not like those abortion mothers, those liberals. I thank God every day I'm not like them. We'll talk about that later. It's something I learned. The gospel is seen, I think, increasingly as a transaction. It's a commodity. It's something we trade in. So I do my part, I expect God to do his part. I fail, I expect God to cover the failures. God, our codependent in heaven. The term therapeutic moralistic deism is thrown around. I think that's the prevailing religion, at least on my side of the board. We vaguely believe in a God. We believe that if we obey his rules, that he will grant us the healing we believe we need, or we think we need. It's affected pastors and the way people view pastors. It used to be the authority of office. My dad, who was a converted, is a Roman Catholic retread, become Lutheran, he went to the same congregation, served in all sorts of capacities from chairman on down. Never elder, didn't want to do that. For all the years that he was alive and living in that community, he'd seen pastors come and go. It didn't matter. They were vacant for 2.5 years. Didn't matter. They had good vacancy pastors. There was a pastor. That's all that mattered. But that has shifted to authenticity of person. Now you have to demonstrate. You have to show me that your word is relevant to me. You have to demonstrate by how you live, what you do. We're going to watch you very closely. If you slip, we write you off. We write your gospel off. We write everything you say. There's nothing. And that puts a lot of pressure on us, I think. I think that's why a lot of guys break in office. I think it's why you see the amount of broken pastors that you do. You put somebody under the law, under guilt, under the constant scrutiny, not only of the inner critic that says, you suck, you suck, you suck, but the outer critic that says, you suck, and I'm not going to listen to you anymore. You put somebody under the constant pressure that a number of things, something's going to break. They're going to resort to stimulate the pleasure center, you know, the porn, drugs, sex, whatever. Or they'll do what I've discovered is a great trick of the old Adam. You're so afraid of breaking the law that you just break the law. I had a woman who was so afraid that her husband was going to have an affair, which he did, that she had an affair before he did, just to beat him to the punch. What kind of logic is that? It's like having a vase that's so precious, you put it up on the thing you want, don't go near it. You know, you got a burglar alarm along, motion detectors around it, it's all there, don't go near it. And your whole life revolves around not breaking this vase. And finally, one day, you just kind of come up and smash it, now you're free. That's what that woman did. She just had to be free, so she had an affair. But I think that's why guys have meltdown in office. They are under such a burden of the law to grow, to be pure, to whatever the standard is, that they melt down, and they melt down in some flamboyant ways. And I think we would do each other favors as pastors to be on the guard for the one among us who is really under the oppression of the law. And whose inner critic is screaming at him. What does Paul say in Romans 2 about the conscience? The conscience does one of two things. It accuses, you suck, or it makes excuses. You suck because your kids take up too much of your time. Your wife is too needy. These congregation people don't appreciate you. You need a new call. See? But you are good. You are justified. That's why for Luther, see, the gospel does not bring a new conscience, a Christian conscience, no such thing. It brings a quiet conscience. What he calls a happy conscience. How do you make your conscience happy? Take away the law. It's got nothing to work with anymore. That's Luther's, shut up, I'm baptized. When your conscience or the devil accuses you, you say, not, I'm trying harder, really. I'll approve, you know, right? Or, you know, it's her fault that I didn't get this done. You say, shut up. Nevertheless, I'm baptized. You know, that's what we say in the Large Catechism. That's what you do with a conscience. You tell it to shut up. Christ has done this. Can't accuse you anymore. Just shut up. Now, if the old Adam gets out of line, you tell him to drop dead. We'll get on to that. That's it. Here's the nugget. Let me get to it. Preaching is foolish. It always has been. Paul said so. But today, we are the court jesters and the village idiots. And we should embrace this. Because in the king's court, the only one who could tell the king the truth was the jester.
Like King Lear, right?
Huh?
Like King Lear.
Yes. And the king, the wise king, knew to listen to the jester because see, he could do it because if he got caught and somebody got upset, just kidding. I think Paul was really onto something when the Corinthians were comparing him to the super apostles, the Joel Osteens of his day. And he recognized that he was a bad public speaker. Apparently he was short and kind of funny looking. And he didn't have the great oratory skills that they so valued in the Greek world. And he says, I just came to you preaching nothing but Christ and Him crucified. I'm an idiot for Christ. Deal with it. And I think we have to embrace this because the world is acknowledging we're idiots. All right, that's fine. Let's talk about Christ. Let's be idiots for Christ. People want relevance, and yet they trivialize everything. It was Neil Postman who said that television would trivialize the world of politics, the world of education, and the world of religion. He was a prophet. He's absolutely right. He said that the mixture of audio and visual, with visual dominating, would trivialize politics, the sound bites. It would trivialize education, entertainment. And it would turn religion basically into some sort of spiritual pattern. And it did. It did. We also have to deal, and you're dealing with, institutionalized agendas. Everybody wants in on the sermon. We're not making enough money, Pastor. You've got to preach more stewardship. This death and resurrection thing's just not... Yeah, I think there's something weird about the offering being after the sermon. It's like the Nielsen rate. Yeah. How'd it do? Somebody asked me, how do you file your sermons? I said, by the offering amount. Well, that wouldn't work. Let's break that one out. No, I'm just kidding. But you know, it's like an institutional concerns will swallow up everything. And institutions are congregations, districts, synods. It doesn't matter. But institutions are beasts. They're hungry. And they want sacrifice, usually blood. They want you. And they will take over the agenda. Now, they're inevitable. Where two or three are gathered, there will be an institution because we have to agree on who's in charge and what time do we meet. So there's going to be that. But that's got to be kept at bay. And one of our jobs as foolish preachers is to sass that institution. You know, we did that last night. You know, and I think that's a necessary thing. But remember, that thing's a beast. Don't poke it. You know, don't toss marshmallows at it. That thing, that'll bite your head. But at the same time, remember that is not the bride of Christ. Yeah, I have a friend, dear friend, I won't mention his name because you know him more publicly, but he always talks to me, he says, I hate the church, I hate the church. And I said, oh, don't say you hate the church. Say you hate the church's institutions. You can do that, because we did that. I said that at breakfast, you know, two miracles in the New Testament. One, that 120 people, the early church, that gospel spread from 120 to the Mediterranean world in one generation. That's a miracle. Second miracle is that church, which is now worldwide, has survived 2,000 years of gross mismanagement at the hands of men. And God's cool with that. God's cool with that. In fact, I think he likes a weak church. I think he likes a church that looks foolish. Because then, as Paul says, the power does not rest in men, but in God. In the Word of God. Some personal notes. What has changed for me in 10 years? Two books have really influenced the way I think about things, among many. One is a book called Outliers. The basic thesis of the book is that until you put in your 10,000 hours, you're not good at anything. The Beatles weren't the Beatles until they played about 10,000 hours of really bad nightclubs. Until they failed. They realized they sucked. They went back. And after about 10,000 hours, they began to achieve a kind of a tone, a sound, a mastery that caught the world's ear. This is true in any craft, in any vocation, in any profession. You know, I don't want a surgeon who has just learned this technique the other day and wants to try it out on me. At my age, I've gotten to the age now where I like my doctors a little bit younger than me. About 45 is good. 35, not so good. 45, good. He's got his 10,000 hours in. But he's still reading journals. He's still on the cutting edge. My age, not so good. He's coasting. He doesn't read the journals as much anymore. You know, he's going with the old way. No, so I want that 45-year-old guy. He's got, you know, he's... But 10,000 hours, I finally have gotten, after 23 years in the pulpit, a comfort with the pulpit, with people, that, and I think it's just simply the 10,000 hours with the lectionary. Now, there's a danger in that. You think you know what it says. And that gets to my second book, which is called Mastery, by a guy named Leonard, first name I forgot, where he talks about something invaluable, and I think this should be the theme for our retreat here, is he says that those who master things become beginners constantly. They deconstruct what they do over and over and over again. Any golfers here? I mean, I can't golf. The old Adam and golf for me, just it would not work. People want to improve their golf game. What do? You know, your drive. What it hooks or it slices, right? Those are bad things, I think, unless they're under control. But when you want to when you want to get your drive right, you get a coach. What's the first thing he does is he totally destroys your swing. He deconstructs it. I have a friend who's an organist, and she takes she goes to this guy for organ lessons. She's been a competent church organist for a long time, and he totally deconstructs her pedal technique. He says, keep your heels together. And so for the next 4 or 5 Sundays, she's just a disaster. And last example, I had this young woman hanging around the church. Her name is Rebecca, lovely, lovely girl. I met her. I was visiting somebody in a nursing home, and her mother was a caretaker there. She's from Romania, and she had placed second in national competition for 16-year-olds in piano. And in Romania, pianists, they turn out pianists and gymnasts, like there's no tomorrow. And so she's a cute little pixie of a girl, and she needed a piano to practice on while she was visiting her mom. Or somewhere. I said, I got a piano in my church. And so she came and she practiced every day for 8 hours. Coming, you know, 8 in the morning. And it was beautiful. I'd be working my study, Bach, Liszt, Chopin, Rachmaninoff, you know, the whole repertoire. But I noticed something about Rebecca's piano playing is she'd warm up by playing a piece, and then she would start to deconstruct the piece, and then she would spend an hour playing a phrase, and then do a little exercise, and then play the phrase again. And I was talking to her, I said, Rebecca, you never play whole pieces. She goes, I know the piece. She says, this is measure, this is the problem. And so she says, you got to become a beginner at this measure. This is the problem. And I said, that's why I never mastered anything. Because I played too okay, and then I played it good enough. I played tennis till it was good enough to beat my brother. I played guitar till it was good enough to play whenever I wanted to. But I never master anything, because I just go for good enough, and I can't bear the pain of the deconstruction and reconstruction. That's what I think we should do with our preaching. We get bored, do it differently. So here's some of the things that I've been doing. I've given up writing. I've had 2 years of writer's block, so now I just preach from outlines. I have no idea what I'm going to say when I get up in the pulpit, except for these are the points that I want to touch on. It's terrifying, but at least it's entertaining. and people say you got more energy in the pulpit, you know, because I'm starting to become like, God bless him, David Scare. You ever sit through a Scare paper?
Oh, yeah.
I swear, if there was nobody in the room, he would still deliver the paper in exactly the same way. You know, now this is the content is great, but he really doesn't give a damn about, you know, it's the paper. This is not an essay. This is not a theological term paper. This is a sermon. And after 23 years, it finally occurred in my thick head, maybe they want to engage. You know, not dialogue. We're not talking. I don't want to hear from the research, but you know, just the look on their face. You know, that point didn't register. Let's try it again. Let's say it this way. I've discovered this, you know. Anyway, so no more manuscript. 23 years of manuscript preaching out there. So I'm getting hate mail. You don't publish your manuscripts anymore. I don't use them anymore. Deal with it. You got like years of that. Just read it. Go away. And you don't pay for it anyway, so shut up. My preaching is more conversational. I think more rabbinic. I'd be a good Jew. You know, if it wasn't for that dead Jew who rose, I'd be a good Jew. My sermons are shorter in some senses. Capon talks about introductions being front porches. And he said some preachers build a whole annex onto the front of the house. You never get to the front door. I sort of sit through some narrative preaching where the story, it just goes on and on. It's like, you know, what's the point or the text or the reason, what's the meaning of my life, why am I here? And so now I just do, you kind of a bit of it yesterday, I just launch into the narrative. They were hiding. Or if it's a topical sermon or a doctrinal sermon, just basically, parable of the vineyard workers. Okay, the typical intro to that. God isn't fair. He's gracious, but he's not fair. Okay, so I just announce what the whole thing is about. I don't like wasting time with intros. One point, I'm getting old, I can't remember things anymore. So, but I like the way my mind works. I'm a detail person. And as I got older, as I'm getting older, I can't keep details in my head anymore. So I make a lot of lists now. And lists are cool because then I don't forget what I'm supposed to do. But I've discovered that it's easier to preach on one thing than on many things. And it's easier for those people who have no idea what you're going to be talking about to hear about one thing than many things. And we're actually kind of connecting after 23 years. And that doesn't mean it's just one point over and over again, but it's one point with some satellite things orbiting around it. And I'm going to go over that a little bit as we kind of progress as to how that's kind of worked out for me. But it makes me more comfortable in the pulpit, because if I go off road, I know how to get back on the road again, because that's the point. What was the point yesterday? Family. And the subsidiary point, hiding. That's really all I needed. I still don't trust it, so I had a lot of handwritten scribbling thing that I couldn't read, you know. And so you're looking down and your inner voice is going, you're an idiot. You can't even write. You know, you can't read your own handwriting. You know, but it's fine. The other aspect of preaching that's changed a little bit for me is I've come to see sermon as midrash. I told you I'd be a good Jew. And what's midrash? Midrash is continual extended commentary. You cannot cover everything of a text in a sermon. You can cover one thing that has occurred to you about the text in the sermon. And the life of preaching and hearing is like building a finish on a piece of furniture. You don't glop a big, thick pile of shellac and then hope it dries. It'll just turn into a sticky mess. You lay down a thin layer after another, after another, after another. That's what preaching and hearing in season and out of season does. It lays down veneers, thin veneers, one point at a time, across the lectionary, the festival season, the non-festival season, the text you don't want to preach on, the texts that are easy to preach on, the festivals that preach themselves. You know, if you actually have to write a sermon for Easter after 23 years, what the hell have you been doing? You know, I have some colleagues, you know, oh, they asked me to preach tomorrow, or I don't have time for that. It's like, I saw President Harrison, now granted, you know, he's got a road gig, I understand this, you know, but he preached on the text in my church, dog tired, he fell asleep on the couch in our youth room. I fed him well and I gave him high-end tequila the night before and freaked his mind out. There were some of the freaky things I think about. But he sits there and he says, you know, I was going to do this. I'm not going to do that. And he takes out a piece of paper. He scribbles down three things. He's got his Greek text in hand. He gets in the pulpit, and he preaches. And I said, that's 10,000 hours, right? That's mastery. And was it eloquent? No. It was preaching. and the people were, they're just like, you could, even the kids were quiet that day. The kids act up because the parents are fidgeting. That's my son. Should we break? Let's break.
That's not to break.